I think I'm entitled.
You want answers.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
The debate started with a jab from DeSantis, reminding everyone of the moment Californians won't forget, Newsom going to the French Laundry during COVID. He also brought props showing a poop map of San Francisco, while Governor Newsom defended California's gun safety measures and tax rates. One thing was clear, their ideologies couldn't be more different. California Governor Gavin Newsom went toe-to-toe with his East Coast political foil, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
I thought this guy was running for president of the United States.
You just won't admit it.
DeSantis is running for president. Newsom says he is not. So why debate?
I'm here to tell the truth about the Biden-Harris record and also compare and contrast Ron DeSantis' record and the Republican Party's record.
Wow. For DeSantis to say, you know, I'm here to make sure we understand everything and bring out a poop map to show here's what you live with in California. And then you got Newsom saying, I'm here to tell the truth about the Biden-Harris presidential aspirations and accomplishments. Okay, so on one hand, you got a poop map from California, and over here you've got a pile of accomplishments by Biden and Harris. They're all kind of together. Glad to have you with us. Here we are, December 1, 2023. This is the first of 2 hours of Larry Connors USA, back to back. And of course, reminding you, when we're on the air, we're also streaming at Larry Connors USA Facebook and Twitter, News Talk STL Facebook and Twitter, and on Rumble, so you can watch the program. If you miss any of it, either the video or the audio, you always find it at LarryConnorsUSA.com. It's always posted. A guy came up to me last night and said, I want you to meet my daughter. I tell her, I listen to your podcast all the time. I said, I appreciate that, but you know, it is a radio show. She said, yeah, but I don't get a chance to listen then. So I love the podcast. So we're glad to have you either way. Whatever works for you, works for me. Just glad to have you on board. There is a piece of news that I want to go ahead and get out of the way now, and it kind of fits with just this battle that went on last night, so-called debate. We're going to break it down in more details for you. But today, the House did expel George Santos because of numerous allegations of criminal conduct on his behalf, lying and everything else, and basically taking credit card numbers, according to some of the allegations, of folks who were sending him money for his campaign for Congress and using their credit card numbers to go make personal purchases. So they finally got around to expelling him. Now he's going to face criminal charges. But on the way out, after being expelled, Santos said, to hell with this place. I got his point across. And then we go back to hell with the red state versus blue state issue, because there are folks that see nothing of value coming out of last night. And, of course, if you're looking at the two candidates, we remind you again, DeSantis is actually running in the Republican primary for president. He is way behind, which Newsom took an opportunity to point out last night. Gleefully, understandably. And then you also had Newsom claiming that I'm just here to represent the good values and the accomplishments of Biden and Harris. It was a billed as a blue state versus red state battle, and that's kind of what it came down to. So let's pick up a piece of it, beginning with DeSantis.
You have the freedom to defecate in public in California. You have the freedom to pitch a tent on Sunset Boulevard.
According to Housing and Urban Development, Florida's homelessness rate fell by 45%, while California's went up 45%.
Gavin's buddy in Los Angeles, Gascon, he doesn't even prosecute. People are leaving California in droves because he has failed to stand up for public safety. That city has collapsed. That county's collapsed.
Here's what's happening.
Newsom defended California's efforts, citing more spending on the issue in the next fiscal year. The coastal leaders traded comparisons on state abortion laws.
Decided to sign a six-week ban before women even know they're pregnant, Ron, before women can even access a doctor's appointment.
Now, of course, abortion is going to be a big issue again. It's a tough issue for Republicans who are willing to accept abortion under certain circumstances, and the other Republicans who say no abortion under any circumstance. There's still the division in the party to that extent. And I will point out to you, the same division exists also inside the Democrat camp, but for the most part, they're staying silent. So both of them are talking about what they see as the differences between the states. And I think we all see it. We know it. The crime rates, immigration issues, inflation issues, on and on and on. And that was the entire purpose of this. Sean Hannity, sole moderator, and not cutting them off after 5 minutes, giving them free rein pretty much, and then coming back in. I didn't watch it as it occurred. I've watched it since. But I've got the best of it pulled out for you that you're going to hear as we go through the show. And you've heard some of it already. But I also want to give you the value and the response from some of the analysts, and especially those on the left. One of them would be Leah Rigger for CNN.
I'm not so sure that the country gained a lot. I think in theory, the idea of two governors really duking it out to talk about policy issues and significant ideological differences is something that the American people have been missing for a really long time. I'm not so sure that that's what we had last night. Instead, I think what we saw were two candidates who were really just pitching to their own audiences. I know Newsom said a lot about wanting to speak to Fox News viewers and, you know, introduce himself to new audiences.
Remember, he did that Red State tour.
Right. He did the tour. He also has gone on Hannity before.
Yep.
But it's also true that, you know, with somebody who is a communicator like Newsom, it looks like a highlight reel, right? Like, this is perfect for later on as he is, you know, trying out for various positions, trying to raise his national profile. I actually think the person who needed this the most was Ron DeSantis. His campaign is falling apart. It's flailing. It's all over the place. And this was actually a different Ron DeSantis than we've seen before. It wasn't terrific, but it was a lot more energetic than we've seen him, and feistier than we've seen him in the past. And for him, that's good enough.
And I really can't argue against her points there. It did make DeSantis look better, more combative, prepared, fast on his feet. It's almost, you know, left punch, right punch, a hook, a haymaker, maybe one close to the belt. And for Newsom, as she said, it's also creating a highlight reel of what he could show. Of course, there are pieces he's going to have to cut out where where you've got Governor DeSantis showing the poop map of San Francisco, where not to go, so you don't step in it. And then the homeless people and the needles on the streets and the fact that when everybody was under lockdown in the state of California and most of the nation, certainly the blue states, Governor Newsom decided he was good enough to go have dinner at the French Laundry, which is a high-priced cafe and restaurant in Napa Valley. And with him, several lobbyists for the pharmaceutical companies. Perfect timing. So we all have to edit some of that out. Now, after the debate was over, they each had a little response, you know, on how they thought they did. I want you to hear from DeSantis on his post-debate on what he thought he did and maybe where DeSantis might have done better than Newsom and where Newsom maybe didn't.
This is a debate about the future of the country. And you see the model that California has done. That's the model for the Democratic Party. That's where their energy is. That's what they would do in a second Biden term, a Harris term, a Newsom term. And then you look at Florida, and we really have a model to reverse the skids that the country's on now and get us on a much better pathway. And I think you saw those contrasts. Clearly, the results speak for themselves. You know, you can put a graphic up that says very clearly, you know, he would try to spin out of it. But the reality is the reality.
Reality is reality. Now, speaking of reality, Hunter Biden back in focus. Hunter Biden and his suspicious illegal dealing, maybe treasonous deals with foreign governments involving daddy, especially China. You know, there's a bank examiner's report that was filed in 2018, which means Obama knew about it. It was apparently brought to his attention in 2018, and that is now a new focus. Miranda Devine, New York Post, explains.
This is, you know, an impartial bank executive who's charged with protecting the bank from money laundering and other nefarious activities. And there you see that he's flagged four or five serious concerns with this $5 million payment from China, much of which went into Hunter Biden's bank account. And as you said, this is in the backdrop of the Chinese Communist Party trying to compromise American politicians via bribing their family members.
Now, that's a very big deal, because with that story, and it was originally, as I say, the bank examiner's duty, his fiduciary duties are to his bank. And so he's got to watch as to who we're giving money to and under what conditions, and are there suspicions that we need to be aware of and that might put us in jeopardy? And he was obviously watching and seeing all of these flags come out under the SARS reports, the suspicious activity reports a bank is required to file, and so many of the flags were popping up around Hunter Biden. And he began to look at all the monies that were going back and forth in various, as he said, erratic timings of money and suspicious and nothing very clear as to what was being done in exchange for the money. And that's always been the question, hasn't it? And we now know, basically, and understand that the big deal was that it was going to be simply access to daddy, and daddy could make things happen as vice president at that time, and of course, if he became president, which was expected, he would immediately follow Obama at the end of his term. So all of this known back in 2018, the bank examiner is not in a position to make it public at that point. The bank didn't do so. How many others knew? Well, the one thing that does come down is that it's most likely that, yeah, Biden, his son's activities were transmitted to the president. I mean, when you've got your vice president's son doing business dealings with a foreign adversary or just a foreign country, period, and getting money for various things that can't really be explained, there's a question of treason. There's a question of national security. There's a question of what the hell? And as the bank examiner was filing his reports, he was just simply seeing it going into a circular waste bin somewhere. But now it's back in front because James Comer and his committee came across it and all the things they've been collecting. And they're looking at these bank reports and records. Now, I know there are folks out there that say, well, where's the proof that Joe Biden got any money, a one dime, from China? Do I have that? My answer is I do not have that. What I do have is how many times Joe Biden has denied knowing anything anything about Hunter Biden's business, anything about his partners, never meeting with them, wasn't even aware of what, and my son getting money, what, for, what's this thing you call China? I mean, totally clueless, and we're supposed to believe that? I'd rather believe the suspicion that he got more than a dime. I'm looking at a piece here that Congressman Dan Goldman, Democrat in New York, he is still drinking the Russian Kool-Aid, as reported by the New York Post. He's basically in a subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government. In that hearing, he apparently tried to bully the investigative journalist Schellenberger, who's done essential work exposing how federal power and big tech companies were creating a censorship regime. And Goldman boldly, falsely claimed, the New York Post admitted here that the copious evidence from Hunter Biden's laptop of his shady acts was not authenticated as real. It could somehow be manipulated by Russia. No, that's never been the statement of the Post. The Post has never admitted anything. They questioned its stories about the laptop. If anything ran similar to that, they were quoting someone else who was questioning it. Brenda Devine says the examiner, when he's looking at all these suspicious things about the money, and then you looked at Hunter Biden himself and his personal issues, oh, it really went from yellow flags to red flags.
This bank investigator had been watching Hunter Biden because, you know, he had money problems. There were reports from his divorce that he was spending enormously on drugs and alcohol and prostitution. Then you have the fact that he was a politically exposed person as the son of the vice president, the fact the payments were erratic, and that they were being paid for no discernible service. Supposedly they were a loan, a business loan, but there were no documents and no terms for that supposed loan. That's a story that James Comer has been telling across a whole lot of different bank documents. Loans, they don't appear to be, and that's a classic excuse the IRS always looks for when people are trying to hide the real source of money.
Yep, you always start looking for that. I hear somebody else who's going to have to start looking for ways to come up with some explanations, going to have some splaining to do. New York City Mayor Eric Adams, he is facing right now an FBI probe into his campaign fundraising in 2021. So the mayor has now set as a need for his defense fund over the next 2 weeks, we need to raise $500,000 by mid-December. He's asking all those New Yorkers who believe in what he's doing for the city is good, send me your money. Send me your money. Help me defend myself against these charges from the FBI. Oh, that's going to get good. In our next hour, GOP senators pushing for China travel ban because of a suspicious illness surfacing and China's balloon flight, what it might have actually achieved. Plus, the CEO of Stone Ledge Distillery on making whiskey in Missouri. But coming up next, we'll be updating the end of the ceasefire in Gaza. But I also want to go behind the scenes of Bill Clinton's effort to create a two-state solution for the PLO and Israel. And it fell apart, and you're going to hear pretty much why. Lock and load, ready on the right.
You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
Hundreds of homeowners and businesses had or will have water main breaks. Wellington Environmental has a warning. You can clean up the water, but if you're not checking areas where the water leaked in the walls where you can't see it, you could end up exposing your family, your employees, your clients to hazardous mold. Wellington Environmental reminds you, if that mold is not detected, properly treated, removed, that is a risk, a liability you do not want. Wellington clients, including hospitals and schools,
Trust Wellington to make their environments safe. Call 314-644-4930. 644-4930. AAA rating with the Better Business Bureau. 314-644-4930. Wellington Environmental. Your world. Cleaner. Better. Safer. Be well with Wellington.
Tim Jones and Chris Arps in the afternoon.
Horace, Americans individually have lost over $4,000 in income and over $7,000 where you have a household with both parents working.
It shouldn't be, it's the economy, stupid. We should just say, stupid! It's the economy. Unbelievable the devastation that Americans are feeling.
Tim Jones and Chris Arps, weekdays at 3:30 on News Talk STL.
Planning a party with family, friends, maybe a business party? Cafe Napoli has four locations, and each has rooms to fit your needs. But a word to the wise, book early. Cafe Napoli in Clayton, Cafe Napoli in Town and Country, Napoli 3 on the streets of St. Charles, or right next door, Napoli C. Also get some Cafe Napoli gift cards, good for all locations, anytime. I'll see you at Cafe Napoli.
This is Christina Strait with Strait Realty reminding you why pay more than four. In 2003, we had a dream to start a real estate company that would revolutionize the real estate market. Now, 20 years later, after navigating through the many markets ups and downs, we know exactly how to help you in this challenging time. I'm Christina Strait, owner Strait Realty. Don't give away your hard-earned equity. Give us a call today. 314-441-4444. 314-441-ALL-4s. And remember, why pay more than four?
Strait Realty is a licensed broker in the state of Missouri.
You want to give a unique gift this holiday? I suggest Stolach Whiskey, produced in Missouri. Stolach Whiskey, born of natural limestone filtered water from the Ozark Highlands, aged in Missouri oak. Stolach, so smooth. Trust me, you're going to enjoy it. So next time, ask for Stolach. Visit the website, stolach.com. Stolach, Stolloch, from Stone Ledge Distillery.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
Take a look at the activity right now over the Gaza Strip. As you can see, we have been watching smoke illuminating from the region. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has ended, with fighting resuming this morning. Hamas failed to provide a list of hostage names needed for the extension of that ceasefire. John Negroponte, my next guest, joined the program back in October and said he would not give up on the idea of a ceasefire in Gaza. Here's what he said then. Watch.
If at some point the parties agree to resume, even in principle, some kind of political dialogue, which has been notably absent in the past several years, towards a fundamental resolution of the Palestinian problem, that too could be a basis for some kind of a ceasefire. So I wouldn't give up on the idea of a ceasefire.
He says he doesn't really want to give up on it, but at the same time, the ceasefire is over for right now. And it all came to an end when it became clear that no more hostages are going to be exchanged for a while. And Hamas wanted to up the ante. We want more Palestinians released from Israel being held on whatever charges. And we want more of this and more of that. Are we willing to go ahead and continue to hold the hostage? And we've already been told that Hamas gave, sold at least those two red-headed brothers, as they're known, and others to other terrorist groups inside Gaza. For what and why and what's going on behind the scenes there, you can speculate all day long, but the news continues to come out as now the soldiers are back in action, the IDF, and they just found the body of a grandfather and maybe one or two of his grandchildren. There's also a statement that apparently Biden has now heard the word
I'm sure he has. But Blinken, who he sent over to deal with trying to keep this together, Blinken basically ended up scolding Israel, saying it lacks the credit to defeat Hamas. Now, by credit, I mean, again, that kind of information coming out, that's not going to help anything on either side. But according to remarks leaked to the Israeli press, the Times of Israel stating, and I'm quoting from Blinken, "You can't operate in southern Gaza in the way you did in the north. There are 2 million Palestinians there. You need to evacuate fewer people from their homes, be more accurate in the attacks, not hit UN facilities, ensure that there are enough protected areas for civilians. If not, then not to attack where there is a civilian. What is your system of operation?" He's asking the IDF chief. And he said, "We follow a number of principles, proportionally, distinction, and the laws of war. There were instances where we attacked on the basis of those, and instances where we decided not to attack because we waited for a better opportunity." The defense minister then added, "The entire Israeli society is united behind the goal of dismantling Hamas, even if it takes months." And Blinken then makes the remark, "I don't think you have the credit for that." Credit what? In more money from the U.S.? More support, the ability. So once that kind of word gets out to Hamas, they can kind of think, we don't have to give anything up anymore. Which brings us back to the guest Maria Bartiromo had on in the past, and she wanted to get his latest view. We're talking about John Negroponte, who was a former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., now on the value of any ceasefire.
Very often in the past, I've lived in a few other situations where there was a hope that a pause or a truce. We used to have Christmas truces in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And there was always people, including Lyndon Johnson, who was hoping that maybe you could use the truce to extend it into something more enduring, more permanent. And almost always our hopes were dashed. So I think that's what's happened this time. I still don't give up on a resolution to this problem over time, but I do think it involves this fundamental question of the Israelis having to be willing to talk about a Palestinian state living at peace side by side with its neighbor Israel. And unless you talk about the fundamental solutions, I mean, this kind of activity, I think, is going to go on.
Well, we have been down that road in the past. In fact, 23 years ago, the Israelis and Palestinians were talking about a two-state solution. At the time, you had Yasser Arafat heading up the PLO, and Israel had a new leader at that time. And I want to let you hear part of a report filed by NPR's Scott Detrow. I take it back. This is not Detrow. This is from another source. This is Ian Bremmer doing a report on that date almost 20-plus years ago.
23 years ago at Camp David, Palestinian Liberation Organization chairman Yasser Arafat was watching the Major League Baseball All-Star game on TV. As a U.S. diplomat later recalled, Arafat asked at one point when the game would start. It was, in fact, already the fifth inning. I can see that happening. This little exchange, kind of funny, brought the sense of misunderstandings to come. The summit was only the second time in 40 years of U.S.-led efforts at brokering peace that an American president brought together Israeli and Arab leaders. In September of 1978, then-President Carter successfully brokered an historic peace treaty between Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin. But back to that two-week summit in July of 2000. It was the last 6 months of President Clinton's presidency, and he was eager to cement his legacy by solving the most intractable problem in the Middle East. And here's Clinton announcing the summit in the White House briefing room a week prior.
If the parties do not seize this moment, if they cannot make progress now, there will be more hostility and more bitterness, perhaps even more violence. And to what end?
And to what end? Again, that's part of a report filed by Ian Bremmer.
on behalf of what was happening at that point. And it goes on in one piece that NPR did, according to one of those who was an ambassador involved with it as well, said he said that for 2 weeks Clinton cajoled, talked, yelled, arm-twisted, trying to get them to agree to a deal to allow their people to live in peace. But back to the Ian Bremmer report, he says Israel's pressure was building.
Ehud Barak, the young leftist Israeli prime minister, fresh off a series of failed negotiations with Syria, had pushed hard for that summit, arguing that it was, and I quote, a pressure cooker that would require him and Arafat to make real progress on a two-state solution. According to Aaron David Miller, an American diplomat who was at the negotiations, Barak's strategy was either to secure a deal or to expose Arafat as an unreliable partner. Barak was also feeling a different kind of pressure at home, given his increasing domestic unpopularity. His own government, in fact, began to unravel just as the summit was underway. Meanwhile, Yasser Arafat had constraints of his own, given his constituency's mistrust of Israel and his resentment of Barak's recent focus on Syria. Arafat was himself in no hurry to reach an agreement. He had warned President Clinton ahead of the summit that his side was not ready to come to the table, nor did he trust Barak to follow through on his promises.
Now, I want to stop it there for just a moment. You've got the new Israeli prime minister that's already facing a backlash among some of his people, Ehud Barak, and you've got the PLO leader, Yasser Arafat, saying, I don't really believe this guy will live up to whatever he tells us he's going to because I don't think he can control what's happening in his country himself. That was Yasser Arafat's approach on it. So with both of those in mind again, let's go back to where the trust lies, and here you're going to hear a clip and a suggestion that this was not a fully above-the-table negotiation.
Arafat was himself in no hurry to reach an agreement. He had warned President Clinton ahead of the summit that his side was not ready to come to the table, nor did he trust Barak to follow through on his promises. And given the United States' airtight relationship with Israel, Arafat was right to be suspicious. Clinton had, in fact, a no-surprise policy with Barak, which meant, in essence, that the summit's purported mediator showed everything first to the Israeli delegation. With Israel as a key ally, it's not like the United States was an honest broker. And in the end, despite Clinton's best efforts, southern charm, and the summit's lovely setting, the talks did end in failure.
After 14 days of intensive negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, I have concluded with regret that they will not be able to reach an agreement at this time. They couldn't get there. That's the truth. They couldn't get there.
Couldn't get there. And that's where we are today. And Israel, of course, is worried about enemies all around it. They gave Gaza to the Palestinians, trying to find some way to make peace and live together. And it had been successful up until October 7. Well, it really wasn't successful because behind the scenes up to October 7, Hamas was already planning to attack Israel and building this vast network of tunnels where they could hide and carry out what they wanted to. And they were often firing from civilian populations inside Gaza, just daring Israel to fire back and kill civilians. A two-state solution would mean you've got already on the West Bank, that's controlled by the PLO. You're going to have Gaza controlled by the PLO again. And Israel obviously has reasons to fear what would happen next. And then throw in another piece of concern. This one coming direct from China. China says it wants concrete, it wants to see a concrete roadmap for a two-state solution. So China is bigfooting into this right now, saying, you guys have to come up with a two-state solution. China, meanwhile, is funding Iran, which is funding Hamas and Hezbollah, and on and on. So that's not so hard to understand at all, is it? Two-state solution means Israel will be totally surrounded. Coming up, the story of when Obama was doing everything he could to allow secrets to leak out about Trump.
Yeah. You can connect with Larry on Twitter at Larry Connors USA.
I got an email which brought a smile. A woman named Mary wrote me, "We are purchasing a new roof from John Beal based on your recommendation." I thanked her then. I do it again now. Mary, I only endorse clients I believe in, and I've been a spokesman for John Beal for 10 years. It's all about trust. So if, like Mary, you need John Beal, trust me. Call 1-800-NEW-ROOF. 1-800-NEW-ROOF.
The United States Deputy Sheriff's Association is a national nonprofit and the largest non-governmental provider of services to law enforcement. The USDSA assists city, county, state, and federal agencies with free safety equipment donations and officer survival training, along with cash donations to families of law enforcement officers who perish in the line of duty, a citizen awareness program, and more. For more information on United States Deputy Sheriff's Association, please visit usdeputy.org.
Vincent's Jewelers has the hottest gift for the holidays. Flexible bracelets. Quality, beauty, starting at just $150. And of course you'll want to check for rings, pendants, maybe watches. I suggest you check the website each day for new items and specials. Vincent'sJewelers.com. Vincent'sJewelers.com. Give Vincent's a chance for your business. Vincent's, locally owned, supporting local charities for more than 42 years. Vincent's, my only jeweler.
News, analysis, opinion.
USA, USA. That's a big game, man.
President, she's really losing control.
People in China didn't ask me about people mowing each other down in a mall.
This is News Talk STL.
It is their responsibility.
Hate is a metastasizing agent.
We're all keeping a close eye on this.
Illegal immigration is crazy right now.
This United States is not being overrun.
News Talk STL.
It is a crisis at the border without question.
At NewsTalkSTL.com.
Lit Cigar wins Best Smoking Lounge and Best Smoke Shop in the Riverfront Times Best of St. Louis listing for 2023. That is 2 years back-to-back. Lit Cigar Lounge and its new space in the district just off Highway 40 in Chesterfield. Lit is for men and women who enjoy great cigars, premium drinks. The website keeps you on top of special events, including live entertainment. LitSTL.com. LitSTL.com.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
So I'm looking at a piece here that was in the Epoch Times, written by Jeff Carlson. The title should immediately catch your attention. How the Obama Administration Enabled the Nonstop Security Leaks Against Donald Trump, pointing out that a last-minute revision to the intelligence community's rules on information allowed for a wider sharing of raw intel on U.S. citizens. So it's not affecting just Trump, but at this point, it was being used to target Trump. Again, Carlson writing, and it's a commentary based upon the facts he has, so I want you to keep that in mind, stating that the Obama administration, just 17 days before the inauguration of President Donald Trump, revised the guidelines of Section 2.3 of the Executive Order 12333. I'm sure you're familiar with that. No, I'm not that familiar with it either. But it deals with the procedures for the availability or dissemination of raw signals intelligence information by the National Security Agency. And although widely overlooked, the implications were broad and far-reaching. This goes back in part to the Patriot Act, right after 9/11, when we felt we needed to have a better way to watch over and monitor and catch information before we would have another 9/11. On one hand, many of us are saying, you know,
I have nothing to hide. Go do it. If it's a way to keep something like that from happening again, do it. But then there's that other shoulder, the little angel or devil, depending on where the other one was, that says to you, but what if they abuse it against American citizens? That is the key issue. So under this new procedure, the agencies and individuals could request the National Security Agency for access to specific surveillance simply by claiming the intercepts contained relevant information useful to a particular mission. In other words, let's look at it like a search warrant. When they go for a search warrant, now I'm not talking about a FISA warrant, that's all part of what we're discussing here, but let's just look at the basic search warrant. They basically have to lay out why they want to go in there, what they expect to find. Of course, once inside, if by chance they find something else, then they have to reconfigure as to how we're going to deal with it. Now, according again to Carlson in the Epoch Times commentary, he said, no privacy protection of the raw data was undertaken. I'll repeat it again in a different phrasing. Nothing was done to protect raw data from being taken. Under the new rules, sharing of information was significantly easier. Information being shared was raw, unfiltered. Almost like the dossier that was being presented and paid and bought for by Hillary Clinton and the Democrat National Committee. Jeff Carlson, in his commentary for Epoch Times, wrote, at the time, I wondered about the timing of that order. Now, again, 17 days before Trump is inaugurated. He said, I wondered about the timing of the order. But what I found particularly curious was that it was enacted so late. And he says, let me explain. He talks about December 15, 2016, James Clapper, the director of National Intel, signed off on this order. Then it got signed and finalized when Attorney General Loretta Lynch signed it January 3rd, 2017. And then when they were being pressed as to why rush this through during the final days of the Obama administration, an order which allowed for significant expansion in sharing raw intel among agencies, was the purpose to enable dissemination of information gathered by those in the Obama administration amongst the intel agencies? And if that was true, why was that not put in place earlier? In other words, if you're trying to make it easier for our intel agencies to respond and transform and share raw, unfiltered information, why didn't you wait? And why didn't you do it earlier? Why did you put it in place as a new president, Donald Trump, was coming into office? In fact, that's exactly the question that Carlson adds in his commentary. Why just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump officially took over the Oval Office? He points to a piece by the New York Times that wrote, the NSA historically filtered information before sharing any intercepted communications with another agency, such as the CIA, or intel branches of the FBI or the DEA, drug enforcement. And then the NSA's analysts passed on only information they deemed pertinent, screening out identities of innocent people and irrelevant personal information. But with that January 3rd, 2017 approval, the associated expansion of sharing all of this could just minimize any rules trying to protect private individuals. He also adds, when Obama's new sharing order was signed, many were wondering, questioning, why do you need to rush through and do this right now?
Was that because possibly, and he doesn't mention it here, but he says, I did hint to some extent, but did it have something to do that there was already some suspicion, Russian collusion, and they were going to use this to do it? He doesn't get into it in great detail, but he does take note that by July of 2017, Congressman Nunes of California, then chair of the House Intel Committee, had sent a letter to the director of National Intel regarding ongoing leaks of classified information and the need for new unmasking legislation to address the issue. And you remember, of course, when you start unmasking someone, identifying who the source is, you're supposed to have a very valid, documented reason as to why they need to be basically exposed. At that time, Nunes said that we found the Intel Committee's unmasking policies are inadequate to prevent abuse such as political spying, and asked for help that it be fixed. That was Devin Nunes at the time, Republican. He could see what was happening. That wasn't the first time he'd made such a request. He did it in months before, after learning that members of the Trump transition team were, quote, being unmasked, that they were under inquiry. All you have to do is let the leak out that, hey, you know that guy? We got something on him. You don't want to touch him. Probably the most evident case that later came up might be General Flynn, who was loved and trusted by Trump and suddenly found himself out of the White House because rumoring, gossiping, and maybe false information. The article concludes when he's talking about how Nunes was trying to get something being done and was talking to the Obama's deputy assistant secretary, and how she was gleefully detailing how the Obama administration had gathered, disseminated intel on the Trump team and how the information was disseminated. She flat out laid it, here's the plan. Gut the chicken, here's the heart, here's the liver, everything. She's quoted as saying, I was urging my colleagues, and frankly speaking, the people on the Hill is more actually aimed at telling the Hill people, get as much information as you can, get as much intel as you can before Obama leaves the administration. Because I had a fear that somehow that information would disappear when the senior people left. So it would be hidden away in the bureaucracy. And then she added, but that's why you have leaks. It's one of those plots that sounds like something out of some spy novel, but it was actually happening inside our own government, and nothing was being done to actually deal with it properly. All right, turning back to last night's debate, which was not so much the differences between Florida Governor DeSantis and California Governor Newsom. It was, as billed by Fox News, a battle between red state values against blue state values. But there is one takeaway. There is one takeaway that a CNN commentator offered, which I think has some value.
You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
You want to give someone something which they will really enjoy? Give them a Cafe Napoli gift card. You pick the amount, and they pick which of the Cafe Napolis they want to visit. Cafe Napoli in Clayton, Cafe Napoli in Town and Country, Napoli 3 on the streets of St. Charles, or right next door, Napoli C. The Napoli gift card. It's the perfect gift for anyone or your entire office. Cafe Napoli. Cafe Napoli.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
I've long wanted to imitate the NCAA March Madness. You can picture the brackets, right? Your office pool. Mm-hmm. Why don't we see more candidates paired against one another? Why can't we see Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis without Vivek Ramaswamy, without Chris Christie? I mean, instead of, I remember being at the Reagan Library in 2016. There were 15 people on the stage. They had to break it up into two. Give me head-to-head matchups, and that's when we can really see what people can do.
That's really, I think, a fair evaluation of getting a better handle than 17 people across the stage and everybody's getting a certain amount of seconds to respond. You don't really get anything out of it other than blah, 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 blah. And maybe whoever yells fastest, whoever has the wittiest line. That analyst for CNN was Michael Smirkonish. But I think his point is well taken. If you looked at DeSantis and Newsom last night, if they were really candidates against each other, you got a very clear distinction on things. But as we said, it was primarily, since they're not really running against each other in a primary, different parties, they're not running against each other in a general election, not now, maybe someday. It was the distinctions between the two. As DeSantis began, say, hey, in the free state of California, you're free to defecate on the streets. And Newsom saying, I'm here to defend the Biden legacy. Good luck with that. We have a story I have not had time to get to because of so many things going on. I mean, I'm often drinking out of a fire hose, believe me. You probably have already noted this story. You just haven't heard my response on it. It begins with a game, Kansas City Chiefs at their stadium. And there is a writer known as Karen, C-A-R-R-O-N, Phillips. I don't know if male, female, or whatever claims it might be. I could care less. Well, I take it back. It writes here his claim, so it must be. No, I can't tell by this article. It makes no difference. Basically, went after a 9-year-old white boy at the Chiefs game. He's wearing an Indian headdress. And he took a shot, a picture profile of the child, showing him with black all over his face, as if doing blackface. He didn't show the other side or a head-on shot, which showed the other side of the kid's face was red. He put up the misleading photo of this 9-year-old, the side painted black, and pointing out again that racism. The 9-year-old kid is there for a football game to enjoy, and he was being accused also of the chop. Stop the chop. That's wrong. Well, his dad came to the defense and said, that was never the intention. First of all, I'm just taking my kid to a game. And he said, actually, we have Native American heritage. So we're not trying to diss anyone of any color. So he's standing his ground along with his son, fighting, saying, we are not racist. It's a 9-year-old who wanted to paint up his face. Well, the guy that was writing all of this still claimed that the NFL needs to speak out against the Kansas City Chiefs fan in blackface native headdress. Father said, it's been a crazy days. He said, I've been mad, upset. I'm upset for my son. I'm mad that he's upset. He's devastated. His dream to get on the Jumbotron, and he thought he got it on there, and someone said, yeah, we saw you on Sunday Night Football, but now it's become something for people to claim you're racist. This is where we have to stop this. This is what divides us. Kids are out there enjoying a game, had no intention beyond that. Adults put it into their mind, and maybe yours, not you, but others. Remember our pledge, one nation under God.